5. Boogie Woogie. The acoustics laboratory occupied a lofty, spacious room with several windows that was chaotically cluttered with wooden racks and dazzling bright white aluminium counters loaded with apparatus, assembly benches, newish plywood cabinets from Moscow workshops, and comfortable writing desks that had seen better days in the Berlin building of the Lawrence Radio Company. Big bulbs in frosted fixtures shed a pleasant, diffused white light. There was a soundproof acoustic chamber with sides short of the ceiling in the far corner of the room. It looked unfinished. Its exterior was upholstered with ordinary sacking stuffed with straw. The door, which was a yard thick but hollow, like a circus clown's dumbbells, was open at present, and the cloth door curtain was thrown back to air the booth. Near the booth, rows of copper sockets gleamed in the black lacquered panel of the central switchboard. A diminutive, fragile girl with a pale, unsmiling face sat at a desk with her back to the booth, holding a goat's hair shawl tight around her narrow shoulders. There were perhaps 10 other people in the room, all men, all in identical blue overalls, busying themselves by the light of the overhead fixtures and the pools of brightness from swivel desk lamps, also of German origin, walking back and forth, hammering, soldering, sitting at assembly benches and writing desks. 3 makeshift receivers mounted on aluminium panels without casing provided a medley of jazz, piano music, and songs from the Eastern European democracies. Reuben walked slowly across the laboratory to his desk, holding the Mongolian Finnish dictionary and Hemingway down low. White cake crumbs had lodged in his wavy beard. The overalls issued to the prisoners were all cut from the same pattern, but there were different ways of wearing them. One of Reuben's buttons was missing. His belt was slack and loose folds sagged over his belly. A young prisoner stood in his way. He was wearing exactly similar overalls, but was something of a dandy. His blue cloth belt was drawn tight around his slim waist, and the top button of his overalls was undone to reveal a light blue silk shirt, faded after many washes, but held together around his neck by a bright tie. This young man occupied the whole width of the side passageway on Rubin's route. His right hand lightly waved a hot soldering iron. He had rested his left foot on a chair and his left elbow on his knee as he pored over the diagram of a radio in an English-language journal that lay open on his bench, simultaneously singing, "Boogie Woogie, Boogie Woogie, Samba, Samba." Reuben could not get by and stood there for a moment, with an exaggeratedly meek look on his face. The young man appeared not to notice him.
"Val, my friend, do you think you could pull in your rear foot a bit?"
Val answered, without looking up from his diagram, in short, sharp bursts.
"Lev Grigorievich, back off! Get lost! Why do you turn up here in the evening? What is there for you to do?"
He raised his light, boyish eyes to look at Reuben wonderingly.
"What the hell do we need a philologist for, anyway? Ha, ha, ha!"
3 carefully separated syllables.
"You're no engineer, after all. It's a scandal."
Comically protruding his fleshy lips and widening his eyes, Reuben lisped,
"Baby mine, I've known engineers who kept a soda pop stall."
"Not me," Voluntulia snapped. "I'm a first-class engineer, and don't you forget it."
He laid his soldering iron down on its wire stand and straightened up, tossing back an unruly mass of silky hair the same color as the lump of rosin on his bench. He was fresh-complexioned, his face was unmarked by experience, and his movements were boyish. It was impossible to believe that he had graduated before the war, been in a German POW camp, spent some time in Europe, and was now in his 5th year of imprisonment back in his homeland. Reuben sighed.
"Without a duly witnessed reference from your Belgian boss, our administration cannot—"
"Reference nothing."
Valentine made a convincing show of indignation.
"How dense can you be? Surely you realize I'm mad about women."
The grave little girl couldn't help smiling. Another prisoner in the place by the window to which Reuben was trying to make his way stopped work and listened to Valentine approvingly.
"Your love, I think, is purely theoretical," answered Reuben, his jaws moving as though languidly chewing.
"And I madly love spending money."
"Of which, however, you have—"
"So how can I be a bad engineer? Just think. To love women, different ones all the time, you have to have a lot of money. To have a lot of money, you have to earn a lot. To earn a lot of money, if you're an engineer, you must have a brilliant command of your special field. Ha! Ha! You grow pale.
Valentine's elongated face was tilted provocatively at Reuben.
Got it! Exclaimed the Zack by the window, whose desk faced the young woman's. Got it, Lyovka! I've finally caught Valentine's voice. It's bell-like, that's what it is. I'll write it down, shall I? A voice like that you could recognize over any telephone, however much interference there was.
He opened out a big sheet of paper, on which there were columns of names with ruled squares beside them, and a tree diagram.
God, what a load of bull!
Valentine made a gesture of disgust, seized his soldering iron, and set the rosin smoking. The passageway was clear. Reuben took his seat and also applied himself to the classification of voices. For some time they examined the chart together without speaking.
"We're making progress, Glebka," Reuben said at last.
"Used in conjunction with visible speech, we've got a useful weapon here. Before very long we shall know, you and I, what determines the quality of a voice on the telephone. What's that on the radio?"
The loudest noise in the room was jazz, but where they were, a torrent of piano music from the homemade receiver on the windowsill could be heard above it. A single melody surfaced repeatedly, was swept away in the flood, and re-emerged only to be overwhelmed again.
"Beethoven's Sonata Number 17," Gleb replied. "One I've never really... Just listen."
They bent their heads toward the receiver, but the jazz made listening very difficult.
"Valentine," Gleb said, "do us a favour. Show us how big-hearted you are." "I've shown you already," Valentine snapped. "Who set up that receiver for you? If I unsolder your coil, that'll be the end of it."
The slip of a girl raised her eyebrows sternly and intervened.
"Valentine Martinich, it really is impossible. We can't listen to three radios at once. Switch yours off, please."
As it happened, Valentine's radio was playing a slow foxtrot, and the girl was enjoying it.
"Serafima Vitalievna, this is monstrous."
Valentine bumped into an empty chair, tilted it at an angle, and gesticulated as if he were addressing a public meeting.
"How can a normal, healthy human being not like lively, invigorating Western popular music? You are poisoned here with all sorts of rubbish. You must surely have danced the Blue Tango. Surely you've seen Arkady Rykin's reviews. Ah, but you've never been in Europe either. How could you possibly learn how to live? I do most earnestly advise you to fall in love with somebody soon."
He held forth over the chair back, not noticing the bitter lines round the young woman's mouth.
"Somebody, anybody, ça dépend. Lights twinkling in the night, the rustle of silken gowns."
"He's out of sync again," Reuben said in alarm. "We must exercise our authority."
He reached behind Valentine's back and switched off his radio. Valentine spun around as if he had been stung.
"Lev Grigorievich, what gives you the right?"
The limpid melody of Sonata Number 17 poured out unhindered, competing now only with a rather crude song from the far corner. Reuben's frame was blissfully relaxed. His face was a pair of mild hazel eyes over a beard with cake crumbs.
"Engineer Pliantchikov, do you remember the Atlantic Charter? Have you made your will yet? To whom have you left your bedroom slippers?"
Valentine's face grew serious. He stared into Reuben's eyes and asked quietly,
"Listen, what the hell do you think you're doing? Can't a man feel free even in prison? If there's no freedom there, where can he expect to find it?"
One of the fitters called him over, and he went off despondently. Reuben sank noiselessly into his chair, back to back with Gleb, and settled down to listen. But the soothing cadences broke off suddenly like a speech interrupted in mid-sentence, and that was the modest and unostentatious conclusion of Sonata Number 17. Reuben swore obscenely, for Gleb's ears only.
"Spell it,"
Gleb answered, still sitting with his back to Reuben. "I can't hear you."
"I said just my luck,"
Reuben answered hoarsely, also without turning round.
"Now I've missed that sonata. I'd never heard it before."
"Because you're so disorganized, shall I ever get it into your head?
his friend grumbled. "And a very good sonata it is, too. Did you notice how it ends? No noise, not a whisper. It breaks off abruptly, and that's that. Just like in real life. Where were you earlier?"
"With the Germans. Christmas party," said Reuben with a laugh.
They carried on their conversation, invisible to each other, but almost resting the backs of their heads on each other's shoulders.
"Good for you."
Gleb thought a while.
"I like your attitude to them. You spend hours teaching Max Russian, though you'd be perfectly entitled to hate them."
"Hate them? No. But, of course, the love I used to feel for them is clouded. Max is a gentle chap and no Nazi, but doesn't even he share responsibility with the hangmen? After all, he didn't try to stop them, did he?"
"No, just as you and I do nothing to stop Abakumov or Shishkin Mishkin."
"You know, Glebka, when you come to think of it, I'm as much Russian as Jew, and as much a citizen of the world as I am a Russian."
"I like that. Citizens of the world. It has a clean, unblooded sound."
"In other words, we're cosmopolitans. So they were right to lock us up."
"Of course they were. Although you keep trying to convince the Supreme Court of the opposite."
The radio on the windowsill announced, "Logbook of Socialist Emulation in half a minute." Half a minute was long enough for Gleb's hand to move with unhurried efficiency to the receiver, and, before the announcer could get a single croak out, switch it off as though wringing his neck. His face, no longer animated, looked grey and tired. Priyanchikov was grappling with another problem, calculating how to mount a serial amplifier, and lightheartedly singing, "Boogie-woogie, boogie-woogie, samba, samba."